Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really big one, a thinker whose ideas, forged way back in the Enlightenment, still pretty much shape, well, everything around us.
They really do, from, you know, the price of your morning coffee right up to global trade patterns. His insights are absolutely foundational.
Exactly. So get ready to maybe rethink how nations actually get rich and, interestingly, how your own choices fit into that whole picture.
And we're talking, of course, about Adam Smith and his, frankly, monumental work, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations.
Right, often just called The Wealth of Nations.
Yeah, and it's crucial to say it's way more than just an economics book. It's a really deep piece of social philosophy. It digs into human nature, morality, how society works. Okay, so our mission today isn't just a quick summary. We want to properly unpack Smith's ideas, some of which were truly revolutionary back then. We need to understand the mechanics, you know, how wealth is actually created according to him, and figure out why these, well, 18th century ideas are still so relevant for you, whether you're looking at your own finances or just trying to understand the news. And yeah, we definitely need to talk about the invisible hand.
We absolutely do. At its heart, this deep dive is about understanding the arguments for economic liberty and how individual actions and sort of collective prosperity connect. It's like looking at the DNA of a thriving economy.
Okay, let's get into it. Who is Adam Smith? We hear father of modern economics thrown around a lot.
Right, and it's accurate, but maybe a bit limiting.
So he was Scottish, a moral philosopher born 1723, went to Glasgow, Oxford. Standard stuff, maybe. But what made his view so, I don't know, different, so lasting?
Well, that's the fascinating part. His economics didn't just pop out of nowhere. They grew directly out of his deep background in moral philosophy. You see, before Wealth of Nations, he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments back in 1759.
Ah, right.
And that book was all about ethics, sympathy, how we connect with each other, what drives our behavior socially. It wasn't separate. It was like the foundation.
So he understood economics was about people.
Exactly. Yeah. Not just numbers or resources, but people. Their motivations, how they interact, their natural desire to better themselves, but also connect with others. And then he traveled a lot, saw different economies in Europe.
Right.
Which kind of grounded his philosophical ideas in, well, reality.
So it's not just theory. He was observing how things actually worked based on how people actually are. Not just a numbers guy, but a real observer of human nature and society.
Precisely. His economics are embedded in that understanding. His moral philosophy wasn't just a starting point. It was baked right into his economic thinking. It let him see things differently.
How so? How did that philosophical grounding lead to his big economic ideas?
Well, it allowed him to think about how self-interest, which people often saw as purely negative, could actually produce good outcomes for society as a whole. But first, you have to understand what he was arguing against.
Okay, the context.
Yeah, the dominant economic idea then was mercantilism.
Right, the dragons hoarding gold idea, basically.
Kind of. It was all about accumulating gold and silver. Nations thought that was wealth. So they used protectionism tariffs, quotas, exploited colonies, gave monopolies, all to stack up bullion.
A zero-sum game. My gold is your loss.
Exactly. And Smith just completely turned that on its head. He said, look, true national wealth isn't a pile of metal in a vault.
It's what then?
It's the total amount of goods and services a nation actually produces. It's productive capacity. That's the real measure of wealth. A massive shift in thinking.
Huge. So how did he argue nations could boost that productive capacity, if not by hoarding gold?
Through free markets, driven by individuals looking out for their own interests, competing with each other, and crucially, with the government mostly staying out of the way, mostly. But we'll get to that.
Okay.
And this is where the invisible hand comes in. It's this famous metaphor.
The one everyone knows or thinks they know?
Right. Smith suggested that when individuals pursue their own economic gain, trying to make a better living for themselves, they unintentionally end up promoting the good of the whole community. It's like an invisible hand guides all these separate actions towards a beneficial outcome, often better than if some government planner had tried to orchestrate it all.
That's the bit that sometimes feels counterintuitive, isn't it? That selfishness leads to collective good. How did Smith, the moral philosopher, square that circle? Doesn't that just lead to greed and chaos?
But that's the crucial misunderstanding. Smith wasn't saying greed is good, full stop. He believed competition within a free market is the key regulator.
How does that work?
Well, if you want people to buy your stuff, you have to offer something better or cheaper than the next person.
Right.
That forces you to be efficient, to innovate, to actually serve what your customer society want.
Okay, so competition channels self-interest.
Precisely. It channels it constructively. The invisible hand isn't magic. It's the spontaneous order that emerges when people interact freely, pursuing their interests. But within a system of laws, property rights, and, yes, competition, it's about channeling self-interest, not just unleashing it blindly.
That makes more sense. It explains how, you know, millions of people get fed every day without some central plan dictating who grows what and who drives the trucks. Okay, so if that's the overarching idea, what did Smith identify as the actual engines driving this wealth creation? He gets practical in book one, right? With the division of labor.
Yes, absolutely fundamental. The pin factory example is famous for a reason.
Remind us quickly.
He described a small workshop. If one worker tried to make a whole pin themselves, drawing the wire, straightening it, cutting it, rinding the point, making the head, putting it on, packaging, maybe they could make, I don't know, 20 pins a day. Maybe only one.
Yes, sounds tedious.
But if you divide the work among 10 people, each doing just one or two simple, repetitive tasks, they could produce something like 48,000 pins a day. The productivity jump is staggering.
Wow, okay. And why does that happen?
Smith identified three main reasons. First, workers get really good dexterous doing the same small task over and over. Second, you save tons of time not switching between different jobs and tools. And third, workers focused on one tiny step are more likely to figure out a better way to do it, maybe invent a little tool or machine. Mm. Innovation happens.
Makes sense. But he also connected this to the size of the market, didn't he?
Yes. Crucially, you can only have this super specialization if there's a big enough market, enough buyers to actually purchase all those pins or whatever you're making.
Mm.
Bigger markets allow for finer divisions of labor, which boosts production, which can expand the market further. It's a virtuous cycle.
Okay, specialization needs a market. But what fuels the specialization itself? What allows you to set up the pin factory in the first place? That brings us to book two, right? Capital, or stock, as he called it.
Exactly. Capital is the fuel. Smith saw it wasn't just money. It's the tools, the machinery, the buildings, the infrastructure, everything that enables and enhances that division of labor.
So more tools means workers can be even more productive.
Right. He saw this dynamic interplay. You invest capital, buy better tools, build a factory, which boosts productivity, which generates profit, which can then be reinvested as more capital. He even distinguished between circulating capital, like raw materials and wages needed for ongoing production, and fixed capital, like machines and buildings, for longer-term capacity.
And where does this capital come from?
This was another key insight. It comes from savings. Individual savings aren't just money stuffed under a mattress, he argued. When people save, that money doesn't just sit idle. It gets channeled, usually through banks or investments, to entrepreneurs who use it as capital.
Ah, so my saving actually helps fund businesses.
Yes. It becomes invested capital, which hires productive labor workers who create goods that add to the nation's wealth and fuels economic expansion. He made that link between individual saving habits and national growth very clear. It's about putting resources to work productively.
Okay, so we have division of labor fueled by capital accumulation through savings, all guided by the invisible hand in a free market. Now, having laid out how wealth is created, Smith then went on the attack in book four, didn't he? Against that old mercantilist system.
He really did. He systematically dismantled its logic. He argued things like tariffs, import quotas, banning foreign goods. They were fundamentally harmful.
Why? Don't they protect local jobs? That's the argument you still hear today.
Smith said they force consumers to pay higher prices for goods that are often lower quality than imports. That reduces everyone's real purchasing power. And it misdirects the nation's capital. Instead of flowing to the industries where the country is genuinely most efficient, it gets artificially propped up in less productive sectors.
So it makes the nation poorer overall, even if it helps one specific industry.
Precisely. He argued for trade based on absolute advantage. If another country can make wine cheaper than you can, just buy their wine, and you sell them whatever you make more cheaply. Both sides benefit. His critique of colonialism was also sharp. These exclusive trade rules hurt the colonies and the mother country in the long run by distorting both economies.
Okay, so he's strongly for free markets, free trade. Does that mean he wanted no government at all, like some kind of anarchy? That's how he's sometimes painted?
No, not at all. That's another common misconception. Book V is all about the proper role of government. He was very clear. Government is essential, but its role should be limited and specific.
What did he see as essential?
Three main things. First, protecting the country from invasion, national defense. Obvious, maybe, but crucial.
Right.
Second, establishing and maintaining a system of justice. Protecting property rights, enforcing contracts, settling disputes fairly. Without that, markets can't function. There's no trust.
The basic rule of law.
Exactly. And third, providing certain public works and institutions. Things that benefit everyone, but that private companies wouldn't build because they couldn't make a profit from them directly.
Like what?
Things like roads, bridges, canals, harbors, essential infrastructure. And interestingly, he also included basic public education.
Ah, education too. Why that?
Because he worried about the potential downside of extreme division of labor, that it could make workers narrow-minded, even stupid and ignorant, as he put it. He saw basic education as vital for citizens and for a functioning society.
That's fascinating. So not a minimal night watchman state, but a government that provides the essential framework, security, justice, key infrastructure, and even basic education for liberty and markets to thrive.
That's a much better way to put it. And he even thought about how to pay for it with his famous four maxims of taxation. Taxes should be equitable, certain, convenient to pay, and efficient to collect. Principles still debated today.
It's really striking how relevant these ideas remain. So pulling it together, what are the absolute core takeaways? The invisible hand has to be number one, right?
Definitely. That idea that decentralized, self-interested actions when operating within competitive markets under the rule of law can generate a complex, beneficial social order. It's not about praising selfishness. It's about how competition channels it effectively.
And the power of the division of labor, we see it everywhere in our globalized economy. But also, that important warning he included about its potential downsides for the individual worker.
Yes, that warning is crucial. It shows he wasn't just focused on output. His argument for public education stems directly from that concern for the, well, human cost of hyperspecialization. It highlights his belief in human flourishing, not just economic numbers.
Which connects to his idea of natural liberty, but always within a framework of justice. He wasn't heartless, that quote you mentioned earlier.
No society can surely be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable.
Yeah, that really shows his moral core, doesn't it? Prosperity needs to be widespread for society to be stable and, well, decent. It connects economic progress firmly to social well-being.
Absolutely. Liberty requires responsibility and a concern for the whole society, especially the most vulnerable.
And these historical ideas, they really do touch our modern lives directly, if you think about it.
Constantly.
Personal finance, for instance. Understanding that saving isn't just hoarding money, it's actually contributing to the pool of capital that fuels growth. That changes how you might see your savings account, maybe.
It does. Or think about your career. Specialization is valuable, clearly. But Smith's warning might make you think, okay, I also need to keep learning. Be adaptable, not become too narrow.
Right. And just understanding the news debates about tariffs, trade wars, globalization, it's all echoes of Smith arguing against mercantilism. You can see his framework playing out.
And if you're in business, the core message is still there. Compete, innovate, serve your customers' needs. That's how you succeed in a market economy, according to Smith.
It really hammers home that economics isn't just some dry technical subject. Smith showed it's deeply tangled up with psychology, sociology, politics, morality, human nature itself. So here's a final thought. If economics is that intertwined with everything else, what does that imply for how we tackle really big, complex problems today, like, say, climate change or inequality?
That's a great question to leave with. I think Smith's legacy isn't a set of rigid answers for every modern problem. Instead, he gave us a powerful framework, a way of thinking scientifically about how markets, governments, and individual choices interact to shape our world. He helps us ask the right questions, even if the answers have to be found in our own time, about how we organize ourselves to promote not just wealth, but genuine human flourishing.
A framework for asking the right questions. I like that. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.